Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
I think that it's out of a necessity that younger people will start looking at the banking system as a driver of really negative outcomes in terms of how our economy functions. So I think that there's many young people who are thinking very critically about government and power and starting to make the connections that lead you to private banking cartel as a problem and as an impediment to progress.
That's the voice of a new generation coming to terms with the reality of large private banking interests and their impact on the world that he hopes to build a life in. Henry Jacks is his name, and he's one of several American volunteers that are working in their own way to bring about a new American banking institution, public banks. Hello, and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute. And today we're going to be visiting with several individuals who are what you might call just folks, like us, who are out to change the world, starting with economic justice and fairness by reclaiming control of public money so we can start building a better world. What's the process like that one goes through to get to that point where they take on something that's way bigger than they ever thought they would? What have they run into along the way from the powers that be? How long do they intend to stay at it? I think you'll find the sort of surprising magnificence that lies just under the skin of most of us when we're confronted with conditions or challenges that require new skills and new courage out of our commitment to higher values. We'll get to that in a moment, but let's check in with Ellen now and discuss the financing of what we call healthcare here in the U.S. and how the new Trump administration is approaching it.
It is getting attacked from all sides, left, right, and center, for a variety of reasons. Some call it too much, too much Obamacare, and some call it going too far to the right. Anyway, it's not pleasing anybody. And one good thing about it is that it is going to lead us to Medicare for All, because it's really so much cheaper and so much more efficient, and there's really no alternative. And now we can see there's no alternative. People have gotten used to the idea that we're all entitled to health care, that health care is a right or something, or at least health insurance is a right, and you just can't afford it if it's a public-private thing, because you allow the insurers and the drug companies and the hospitals and the doctors and everyone to drive up their prices, and there's no cap on it. But the whole point of Trump care or of the conservatives is to get government off our backs and to supposedly be revenue neutral, like not to increase the budget. So they're always trying to save money. So then the question is how to fund it. So I have ideas about that. But first, I would discuss what they do in other countries. And clearly, our system is very inefficient. In the U.S., we are paying $9,000 per person per year for health care, which comes to $3 trillion, actually over $3 trillion. In the UK, it's $4,000 per person. In Germany, it's even less than that. If you multiply it out by 324 million people, which is the population of the US, we could have the UK system for $1.3 trillion. We could have the German system for $5.1 trillion. We could have the Canadian system for $1.46 trillion. So we could definitely have it for much cheaper, like half what we're paying now. And the reasons are, supposedly, that those systems are, they cut out all the paperwork, and they're just far more efficient. You don't have to worry about copays, et cetera. I mean, you don't have to do any paperwork. You don't have to figure out what category you're in. Doctors don't have to spend all this time doing paperwork themselves. But our own Medicare and Medicaid we already spend $1.6 trillion on that, which is for only 17% of the population. So there's something, the figures still don't add up. Either our Medicare is also far more inefficient than the British, Canadian, German, Japanese, et cetera, systems, or we're just sicker than the rest of the world, the other developed countries, or we just go to the doctor more often because we sort of have a penchant for taking pills and going to the doctor as a solution to things, or all of the above. It seems we are actually sicker. We have a lower life expectancy and a higher infant mortality rate. So what distinguishes us from those other developed countries? Maybe we smoke more. Nope. It turns out that the Japanese, who have the highest life expectancy in the world, actually smoke 70% more cigarettes per year than we do. In fact, Americans smoke less than most other industrialized countries. So that's not it. Maybe we don't get as much exercise. Nope. It turns out we do as well or better than those other countries. Maybe we're more stressed. Nope. It turns out that we're also do as well or better than those other countries on those measures. So what is it? First of all, we have the highest level of GMOs in the world, genetically modified foods. So we're not getting the nutrients. Second of all, we have the highest level of obesity of all those countries by far. But why is that? Why are Americans overeating? I think it's probably because we're not getting the nutrients in our food. Third is we get the most health care and we get the most drugs. Well, there are a couple of other countries that take as much in the way of prescription drugs as we do. But it turns out that prescription drugs are the fourth leading cause of death after heart disease, cancer, and stroke. This is prescription drugs taken as prescribed. So as John Rappaport points out, you would think they would be doing criminal investigations into that, such a high rate of death. But in fact, the drug companies rule. And it seems to me that the whole problem with a for-profit healthcare system is that for drug companies and hospitals and all those medical equipment, testing equipment, et cetera, their market is sick people. So they have no incentive to get people well. They have no interest in a drug that's cheap and effective and will cure cancer like overnight. That is not, they don't want that. They want drugs that you stay on for 30 years, like blood pressure medicine, that will kill you slowly over time. So our whole model is wrong. Healthcare should be socialized just because it should be something where all parties concerned are looking for the cheapest, most effective cures, remedies, treatments. And then for the question of how to fund it all, if we did the British, Canadian, German, et cetera, plan, we could definitely afford it. We could afford it for what we're now paying for Medicare and Medicaid. If we need more money than that, it seems to me we should be doing quantitative easing for the people. I've written a lot about how you could do that for infrastructure and why it would not be inflationary and would be a good idea and would stimulate the economy. But all that also holds true for medical care for all and for something like universal income guarantee, all those various benefits that people need, education for all those things actually contribute to productivity, contribute to GDP, increase the tax base, and the government actually will get its money back, as we saw, for example, with the GI Bill, which returned sevenfold what spent on it.
So the privatization of public services seems to be the most costly and least desirable approach, isn't it? I mean, we see the same thing in the privatization of public services and public assets. Maybe the problem with our system is that we're totally focused on monetary profits instead of results.
Exactly. Yeah, and you would think if President Trump's approach is that he wants to do the most cost-effective thing, he wants the most return for his money, then he would see the wisdom of Medicare for All or pursuing the British, et cetera, German, Canadian, Japanese plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Ellen, you know, before you did your work, your writing on Web of Debt and public bank solutions and so forth, you did about 10 books on medical issues, and out of that discovered how big pharma and banking collude to prop up a system of unhealthfulness. Is this basically what we're talking about here as well?
Right, yeah, that it's just counterproductive. It does not work. When I started writing about healthcare, I was just writing about natural remedies and sort of taking the, you know, looking at it rather conventionally. But the more I got into it, the more that I could see that there was serious corruption here. And in fact, that's the reason I wound up writing on banking, because ultimately I could see that if you wanted to fix the healthcare system, you had to fix the money system. That it was the big banks that were controlling the money system, and that with their interlocking directorships, they owned the drug companies along with everything else, and they were manipulating everything for profit, as you say.
The largest corporations on the planet are in the fire section, right? The finance,
yeah.
Insurance, and real estate. So we see that the banking interests, the private equity, the private investment interests, the pension funds, our 401ks, everything's invested in continuing to squeeze out and to extract out of these services and the people who use them, basically ourselves, little shekels of return while we live in a dysfunctional sort of system management. So, you know, war and health and, you know...
Right. War is another thing that should not be for profit, because you give this huge industry a motive to kill, to go to war. It should be a totally government thing, it seems to me. I've read that all countries are half socialist, half capitalist. It's just a question of which sectors are protected by government. So right now it's our military and our banking system, which is completely protected by the government, that those are the socialist things, and then we, the little people, are on our own in a capitalist system.
When you look at these systems that we live with, that we sustain, that we really, we give our hard-earned, we work our lives away to feed, you realize that every one of them has failed their objectives. The military, and we call it Department of Defense, well, there's defense against who? You know, we spend tons of money on the military to prop up a mythology and to extend and support distant markets for, again, for monetary interests. And then
you generate a motive to actually create wars where there wouldn't have been wars before, because that's your market. You need a war market, just like disease is the market of pharmaceutical, hospital, et cetera.
And then you've got the insurance companies that hoover up huge sums of money to provide some notion of protection, and which is increasingly less possible given the scale of the disasters that we're seeing and that we're likely to sustain with the becoming changes on the planet, as well as the impacts of larger numbers of people living and requiring more services. I don't know, Ellen. Can public banking fix all of this?
Yes, we certainly think so. Well, including, you know, at all levels. If we had public banking at the federal level, we could be doing quantitative easing for the people. The big objection to that is that the quantitative easing that they have done, they said, was sterilized. In other words, the money didn't get into the real economy. And if you let the money get into the real economy, then it would drive up prices. But that's not true. New money will drive up prices if it doesn't create new goods and services, which is what the whole fire sector does. For example, if you put new money out there and you don't build any more houses, you're going to drive up the price of houses because you've got a limited supply and more money competing for it. But if you use that money to build things, then supply and demand go up together and prices remain stable. So it's all in what you put the money in. You could do quantitative easing for the people and stimulate the economy, generate jobs, put more money in people's pockets, they will pay more taxes, the money will come back to the government, and it will not inflate prices. If you do it like Roosevelt did, where you're issuing loans to all these little businesses and loans for infrastructure. And all that money comes back to the government. So this is done through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation over the course of 20 years that it was in operation, including through World War II when it funded a good part of World War II. They turned a profit for the government. So they actually made money for the government. And meanwhile, they rebuilt the entire country and the money came back to the government. They put the money out there. It builds something. The thing that they built creates profits, which pay back the loan. The loan money goes back to the government, the money supply remains stable, and we've rebuilt the country.
And so why won't they do that, Ellen?
Well, I think they don't understand it. We've had 40 years now of the neoliberal economic model, and so we've got to go do this whole process of re-educating people. But there are a lot of people out there doing it. A lot of our economists that are our people.
One of the things that's interesting about what the public banking movement is demonstrating around the country is that people are really starting to take this very questionable prospect for all of us into their own hands and to address getting services and protecting their assets in a very active and exciting sort of a way to replace the failed financing and financial systems that has basically robbed them of their opportunities and their assets. And I think, people have just had enough. they want to see something new. And I think they also feel like the time is running out,
Yeah. Earth is running out.
The earth is running out, and I think that the chance the powers that be are going to hand down any sort of, create any sort of major systemic change is very, very unlikely. People are certainly cynical about that, and for good cause.
Yeah.
We've seen.
Well, and it seems to me that, you have to give politicians somewhat the benefit of the doubt. They mean to do well, but they don't have a way to do it. If we can create a way or show them, so that they understand, they can print the money and it will not be inflationary if they put it to the right use. Big banks print the money right now and they put it to the wrong use. And that's why we have all these distortions in the market. You need to print it. The government needs to print it and put it to public use.
Well, when you say that they put it to the wrong use, let's get specific. They put it to enriching themselves.
Right. Well, into speculation. So they're not producing goods and services. They're just gambling with other big players. And they create the money. They gamble with it. They win some. And they put it back in the pot and create some more.
And one of the things we're going to hear in the next couple of minutes as we talk to some of the people around the country who are trying to make these changes in their own cities and counties and states is that even if there is credible and demonstrable benefit, significant benefit, to having a public bank at a state level or a city level, that the legislators there are too often captured by the regulatory and the other moneyed interests that say, look, you don't really want to disturb this scene because you like your elected position, and we really don't want you to have, we don't want to have any competition, we don't want people stepping into our turf. And so you see that the people have been very patient with that sort of response, but it's starting to get a little bit more animated out there, which is encouraging because I don't think that we should be expecting any silver platters being handed down to the people through their legislative representatives.
Well, and bureaucracy is there to prevent change, so it's just a very slow process. The slow drip.
drip.
Wear them down. Well, what I see is the positive side of it is that things are shaking up, which means there is the potential for change. You just got to get in there with some better ideas. There's no reason we couldn't have a universal basic income guarantee. Just pay people the money because you need some consumers to buy the products.
And then people can get down to being a human again as opposed to...
Right, doing what they really came here to do, whatever that is, what their chosen work is.
Yeah. Well, Ellen, let's go visit with some of our colleagues. And thank you so much for the time and your insights on this.
Likewise. Great talking to you.
So, as Ellen indicated, the economic system that we live in has profound and intractable failings when it comes to serving the best interests of people. And, of course, you could add to that the planet. In a word, it's hobbled by a priority for profits over service. Yet, despite its overarching power in our body politic, citizens are pursuing a host of strategies and alliances to reshape the dominant monetary regime by creating new American public banks. If you're a regular listener to this program, you're well aware that public banks are common all over the world. But by and large, America is still new to the idea that the money power can actually rest with the people, that the people have a right and a need to access the utility of money, not just for the operations of our mutual affairs, but also for the security and support of all of us. The notion that we have a commonwealth created together, which benefits us all, and that we share a common contract of mutual support and responsibility. What are some of the reasons that people get involved with such a huge undertaking? And how's it going? Are they making any progress? What sort of challenges appear along the way that might make the project seem untenable? Today, we're going to take a look at that evolving, unfolding, and expanding public banking movement. What's going on that regular old citizens, just us folks, from all walks of life, have decided to take on the most powerful forces in our government and in our societal framework? Are we delusional? Are we naive? What fires are burning in the bellies of these protagonists that enable them to wait for years to see some form of viable results, that force them to learn an entirely new language of money and banking, that propel them to find ways forward and create pivotal alliances that can compose a stronger front line of public support for change? With these thoughts in mind, let's take a look at the emerging, exciting, and magnetic American public banking frontier. In Vermont, where the work to establish a Vermont State Public Bank began several years ago, a saga has emerged that illustrates the face-off between the most democratic of citizen petitions and the reactions of a captured legislature. One of the key leaders of this movement in Vermont is Gwen Hall-Smith, an author and global expert on monetary resources. She's a former executive director of the Public Banking Institute and is currently the head of Vermonters for a New Economy. She says the work is personal.
The personal level process is actually, I think, important for people to understand because it's hard. It's actually really hard to keep at something when there's so much opposition to it. And it feels so counter-cultural at times. And, you know, I know that for my part, I take my motivation and ongoing commitment to the issue really from some of my core values, because I think that the current banking and financial systems are undermining our values as Americans, our values as people of faith, and our values as people who care about future generations. They are consolidating wealth and power, denying us a democratic government, destroying our environment, and really making it very difficult to continue to make a living in our culture and our country. So these are important issues, and while public banking doesn't necessarily address all of them, it is actually a very substantial first step to democratizing some of the most important pillars of our economy. So that's what keeps me going, even against the odds, because we are against the odds. And, you know, just recounting briefly the history here in Vermont, you know, gives you an idea of that. You know, we started with this monetary policy advisory group that I started after I published a book on the subject back in 2011. That group was what led to the public banking initiative here. And our first attempt at legislation was to do a study of the impacts of public banking on Vermont. That study legislation was so roundly and thoroughly obstructed by the banking lobby and the people in the administration they have on their side, like the treasurer and the financial services office, that we basically were left with taking matters in our own hands. And we fundraised for the money to do a study, and we did the study without the legislation. And the study showed really dramatic positive impacts on Vermont's economy if we were to implement a public bank here. Over 2,500 jobs created, over $340 million economic benefits to the state, including lots and lots of new revenues from income taxes from all that economic activity. So we came back to the legislature after the study was done, and we got the 10% program passed, while we were trying to get a public bank passed. The 10% program is basically a first step, kind of halfway step, a cash management program by the state to take 10% of the money that's typically on deposit in the big banks and put it into the state lending agencies for lending in state. And that's been a really marvelous success. But unfortunately, the flip side of it is that it has both empowered and emboldened the treasurer, who's the beneficiary of all the political kudos that comes with that, and solidified her opposition to a public bank, because, of course, with a public bank, she wouldn't get all those political goodies from being able to lend out these tranches of money to the state lending agencies and meet some real needs. So anyway, now we're faced with another piece of legislation to establish a commission that's been blocked in both the House Commerce Committee and the Senate Finance Committee. And so again, we've sort of said, well, we really don't need legislation to convene a commission to talk about public banking and what benefits it would have for the state. So on Monday this week, we convened the first citizens commission for a state bank in Vermont at the State House. Over 30 people showed up and over 50 people signed up to be on the commission, and we'll proceed from there. I hope that the legislation passes, although I've got to say at this point in time, with less than 10 days till crossover, I don't hold a lot of hope for it, but I think the legislature still could be convinced to do the right thing. But even if they don't, the people of Vermont will step into their place and make sure that we don't lose the opportunity to learn more from the Germans when they come in May, and also to learn along with the state of New Hampshire that is also pursuing a similar study.
What would you do with the Citizens Commission report?
Well, we'll do with it much the same thing we did with the study. We'll circulate it to the legislators. We'll have people who are running for office made aware of it and make sure to have it be a litmus test of whether or not we'll support them in their campaigns for elected office. We'll develop as much as we can a plan for implementing a public bank, and hopefully by the next round of new crops of legislators, we'll be able to move it further down the field.
You've insinuated the banking lobby has been really behind the resistance. What kind of evidence, understanding of that do you have?
Well, we've seen them in the rooms with the legislators. Their documents that argue why it's a bad idea are virtually lifted word for word by the state authorities who are responsible for giving testimony. It's painfully obvious. When you see a memo that comes out from the treasurer and it basically derides the North Dakota experience because of the proliferation of commercial banks and other things that really have been a positive benefit to the people of North Dakota, albeit not necessarily to the banking community, you got to wonder, who really wrote this? Did the treasurer write it, or did the banking lobbyist write it and she just sort of agreed with it and sent it on out? You know, some of the stuff that is in her testimonies are just not something that you would expect a public official to be raising if they really have the interests of the people of the state at heart.
It isn't just the old guard that's getting on board. The Vermont public banking movement is attracting a younger generation as well. Henry Jacks recently left a college track to become newly engaged, also for personal reasons.
My personal story as a young person who cares about the future of our planet's climate, I began looking into and considering how is the political process in our country actually working? Who actually is controlling the policy that gets made? How is the monetary policy and the monetary system driving some of the other crises that my generation is facing? And those range from student debt to climate change. Austerity and privatization are wreaking havoc on the public goods that previous generations have been able to rely on and expect, and that my generation can no longer. So I think that it's out of a necessity that younger people will start looking at the banking system as a driver of really negative outcomes in terms of how our economy functions. So I think that there's many young people who are thinking very critically about government and power and starting to make the connections that lead you to private banking cartel as a problem and as an impediment to progress. So I think it's out of necessity, and there's also the possibility for radical hope and radical change in terms of when we are able to question the prevailing and dominant systems and delegitimize them. We can think about a banking system and a government that serves people rather than corporations or elites.
And it's interesting to hear how Henry perceives the challenges of explaining what public banking is to others.
I think that there's a lot of different fronts that we're having to work on and push on, because public banking is an issue that's hard to engage with without some fundamental understanding of how banking, how our monetary system works. So I think that the work that Gwen and Vermonters for a New Economy has done in the past 5 years to develop some sort of shared understanding and awareness of the problems inherent in our current banking system has to be part of any campaign for a change to a public bank. In addition to that, we have to push legislators who we know are progressive and who we know do have the interests of Vermonters at the center of their decision making, and then also mobilize constituents and make sure that they're getting in contact with their elected officials to encourage energy, momentum, because the easiest way to kill a bill is to ignore it. And I think that our challenge is to become unignorable, to become something that any individual legislator can't not have an opinion on. And then I think in Vermont particularly, we're facing the situation that Gwen alluded to, where we're seeing a state treasurer having strong and misinformed opinions about the nature of the work and sending those to our legislature. So I've termed that as regulatory capture. We're faced with the additional hurdle of challenging and putting in perspective the misinformation that the treasurer has been distributing. And the clout of the treasurer is definitely something that we're facing and hearing from our legislators about.
That's Henry Jacks and Gwen Hall Smith in Vermont. Now, let's move down the East Coast to North Carolina, where we come across someone who didn't have a deep background in finance or banking, but who did have a deep background in common sense. Mac Arrington, an executive life coach in Greensboro, North Carolina, decided he'd heard enough about how the existing system is designed to let us down, and found out that public banking made a systemic difference. His process has brought out a deep conviction that the unnecessary wasting of money at the expense of people's well-being and public sacrifice is something to work against, and he's made it his purpose to lead his state onto a new, more prudent, responsible path that can make a difference in people's lives.
Well, I found public banking more or less by accident. With the 2008 recession, my business took a nosedive. And so I started trying to figure out, well, what happened with the economy? And the more I read about the economy, the more it didn't make sense. And then I found an article that explained it in terms of the banking system and the Federal Reserve and how that creates a boom and bust cycle, that we can expect another bust about every 10 or 11 years. So I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, well, this is kind of dumb to have a cycle that we can expect to destroy or plunge the economy into recession on a fairly regular basis. And so I started trying to learn more about how we could stop that, and ran across some material by Ellen Brown and dropped a note to Ellen about one of the articles that she had written, and she dropped me this very nice note back and included you, Walt McCree, in the response. And that was my introduction to public banking and how it offers a viable alternative to save us from our own poorly designed monetary system that creates a boom and bust cycle that, on the one hand, builds us up, and on the other hand, throws us into chaos. And that's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
You also took other steps. The next steps that you took were kind of interesting because you reached out right to the State House.
What started happening is after I learned about the advantages of public banking, and then we were able to put together some basic data that showed that North Carolina is wasting hundreds of millions of dollars on interest because we're paying huge interest rates in private banks that would not be necessary if we had a public bank. When you start talking to state officials about, you know, if we had our own public bank, we could save at least $300 million on this public bond issue that we already passed for $2 billion. There's always this moment of hesitation where that sinks in, and then I had the immediate interest of people because, you know, when you start talking about saving $200 or $300 million on a state budget on a bond issue that's already passed, people pay attention to that. It's like, what do we need to do? And so I call it the drip method because I started dripping on a couple of my state representatives and some folks that I had met at a meeting who were part of the lieutenant governor's office. And I was coordinating a meeting with a fellow in the lieutenant governor's office. And he said, oh, by the way, we want to meet with you about this public banking thing. And it's like, oh, really? It's like you drip on these guys for a year, and then all of a sudden it happens. And it's like, oh, and it really took me by surprise. And that was with the general counsel for the lieutenant governor's office for the state of North Carolina. Great guy, very interested. He even knew some of the background about public banking. And so after that, I was talking with one of my state representatives who happened to be the vice chair of the current North Carolina Banking Committee in the legislature. He said, this sounds like an idea we really need to explore. And I'm gradually making my way through people in the legislature, people in the Treasury Department. Now I'm looking to focus on contacting the governor's office. Wherever I can find any little gap that I can plug into and present the idea that, you know, we're spending hundreds of million dollars in interest that we don't have to spend, and we could use that money on infrastructure, on education, on health care, on dozens or hundreds of other needs that the people really have, and we could recycle that money back into the state of North Carolina for the benefit of the taxpayers, rather than handing that over to the big banks who are going to take some risks and gamble with it on Wall Street. It just doesn't make sense to me not to have a public bank.
Well, you had a recent interchange with one of the people in the treasurer's office, which kind of reflected the importance of that large bank presence in the state. They didn't seem to be too excited about shaking the boat.
Well, you know, political change tends to occur slowly. That's why I engage the drip method. And the thing that we find, if you study the history of political change, it requires a two-pronged effort. It requires having people that are already inside the system who have some power or authority to change the system, but they may not have the will or motivation to change the system just yet. And if they don't respond to reasonable pressure to change the system, like, for instance, let's create a public bank in North Carolina, then we have to start expanding our scope. And the second prong of that is to create a public awareness of the problem and the need to fix the problem and potential solutions for the problem. And so at this point, I'm looking at talking with various people who are in the media, you know, writers, publishers, who might have an interest in making the public aware of how much money we are really wasting on interest and how we can communicate that to our representatives at the state level in Raleigh to go ahead and create a public bank. And, you know, for instance, the Bank of North Dakota, I understand, is now making infrastructure loans at 2%. Well, gee, the best rate we can get on the bond issue in North Carolina is 3.5%, 3.5 to 5.75. Just it multiplies the expense. You know, at 5.75% on a $2 billion loan, the interest is $1.8 billion. It almost doubles the cost. So when you look at it like that, it's like, okay, do we spend twice what we really need to, or do we recreate a public bank and spend half and have more money to help everybody else out? I get excited about the possibility, but, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, having been a Quaker activist in the past, you have to enlist for the duration of the engagement. You don't just start and stop and then go away and say, well, this isn't working. No, you have to keep pushing and dripping and stick with it because it's something you really believe in, and it's something I believe that we really need to address because I'm really tired of wasting all the money that could go to programs and to help people who are really needy in the state.
That's Mac Arrington of Greensboro, North Carolina. Let's head out west now to see what the public is up to in the state of Washington and how, even after years of disappointment with the state legislature, they're reconfiguring their strategy to break through legislative resistance. Dennis Ortblad has been at it for 5 years or so, and it's gotten to be a bit like Groundhog Day every year, with repeated dismissals of legislation for a state bank in committees of the state legislature.
Well, I became involved in supporting Bob Hasegawa in Olympia with his state bank bills about 5 or 6 years ago after I retired from the Foreign Service in the State Department. And my motive at the time was that I had witnessed in some of my posts overseas how useful and successful a public bank is in helping governments target certain long-term needs. And that was true in Berlin with my last post with Germany and also in Switzerland and in Japan. So I thought it'd be odd that we don't use that tool here, and particularly when I returned shortly after the financial crisis or during the financial crisis in 2008, the public discussion was dominated by the idea that austerity must rule and we don't have money for any basic needs, and struck me as an odd conundrum, given that we're a wealthy nation, that we somehow have no money for basic needs. So it just seems like as a tool that would be attractive to legislators, public bank makes excellent sense.
Yeah, it is attractive to some, but yet Washington State has had a lot of difficulty getting that bill out of committee.
That's right. So my conclusion after a couple of years is that arguments and persuasion are not important. It could be a great idea, a hell of an idea, but it won't work in a political setting because they're looking to the views of pressure groups. Unless we find the allies, the right number of other groups that would identify with our goal, our arguments don't add up to anything. In retrospect, we ought to have worked even harder trying to win the alliance of our local community banks and especially credit unions. We always use the example of North Dakota's successful public bank as our argument number one. And it's clear that in that case, there's a close partnership between the state bank in Bismarck and all the community banks throughout the state. And that should be a great argument for our own community banks and credit unions here. And I don't think we've been able to make that case, but we probably haven't tried hard enough either.
And the State Banking Association has pushed back pretty hard against the bill. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Bob Hasegawa, because the bill was once again bottled up in the Senate committee, said that it's because of the opposition by the Washington State Bankers Association every time. And the unfortunate situation is that the community banks and even credit unions have largely signed up to the lobby group that represents mostly the big Wall Street banks, because that bankers association, I believe, is dominated by the Wall Street major banks. But for whatever reason, the other banks have fallen in line with them as, I guess, the big boy in the room. We haven't been able to get to these local banks with the argument that actually a state bank would help them preserve their independence and effectiveness. And they face heavy competition from the New York Wall Street banks, but I don't think they see us as allies.
And that, of course, is the case that we see around the country as well. The irony, as you indicated, is that public bank actually becomes the BFF of community banks and credit unions. Public banks should be the best friend forever for these small groups because of the independence, as you say, but because it also drives more business. a more profitable business, and of course helps these local financial institutions stay in their communities. Well, speaking of the communities, Dennis, you live in the Seattle area, and we know that Seattle and Tacoma and even now in Spokane. What about the city level? What's happening there?
The city level, obviously there was a recent opportunity for this issue to crystallize when Wells Fargo Bank told Seattle to get lost. I mean, as you know, the background is that the council voted to divest from Wells Fargo when the contract ends with them, and to show their displeasure, an executive told the Seattle Times that the city will likely have a difficult time finding another bank to take their money, and Seattle was setting a terrible precedent. And thus far, I don't believe there's been any public response to that. Well, I have written a letter to all the council members on behalf of our group asking them to respond directly to Wells Fargo, saying, well, fine, we'll put our money in a public bank. That would be the solution. And I'm waiting for some answer to that, but I'm skeptical that this city will move.
So it sounds like the case hasn't been made quite strong enough in the circles, like the bankers and perhaps at the council level, where they're not seeing, they don't have the vision about what could be fixed. I know affordable housing is a big issue, and you would think that that might be one of the ways in which the Seattle City Council would jump on this.
Yes, that's another one that is pressing. It just seems as though council members see this as risky. They don't feel they should put a lot of political weight behind it, a lot of political capital. And I think it's because we don't get it really into the public discussion very much. There are a lot of people support it, but it's not an issue that they see as pressing, that they mean that they'll get behind it. But they're not willing to take leadership. Yeah. I'm convinced we won't convince the legislators of Olympia or the city council just by the idea of saying this is a good idea. It can be a great idea, but they don't really care.
That's Dennis Ortblad of the Seattle Public Banking Coalition. Down in Portland, Oregon, another multi-year evolution toward creating a public bank is underway. David Delk of the Portland Public Bank Alliance has been at it for a few years now, and they're trying new approaches in a city that's known for progressive policies and practices. A logical place for a progressive banking idea.
Are there particular investment objectives that the citizens in Portland want to try to achieve with the public bank?
Well, we want to grow the local economy and to not grow Wall Street. And so those are two particular objectives that we have. We want to be sure that whatever we do with our money is safe and is not put at risk. Of course, investing in Wall Street puts our money at risk. And so safety, growth, returning money back to the city of Portland for use in infrastructure projects, for social objectives, for affordable housing, those kinds of things, helping the green economy grow. Those are all kinds of things that we would look toward a public bank to assist us with.
And you've had some contact with the Portland City Treasurer. What came out of that meeting, and where's your conversation at this point with the city administration?
So we did have a single meeting with the city treasurer. She gave us some good insights, actually. We kind of expect that she would not support a public bank, but she did not say that. One of her concerns was that a public bank would saddle her and her department with a lot more responsibilities, and she was not looking forward to doing that. And of course, a city bank would not come under the city's treasurer. A municipal city bank would be independent of the city, so she really didn't need to be too concerned about that. But that was one of the things I heard her say a number of times during the conversation.
Right.
And moving forward, with regard to the city, we are developing a list of research questions in order to probably do a citizens feasibility study, and we will present those questions to her and see what answers we can get from her and where else we need to go. We'll take all of that to the city commissioners and present it to them and ask them to pass a resolution funding an official feasibility study. And so that's our most immediate kind of activity. But, you know, that's actually months' worth of work And so we're looking at this as a long-haul effort. So even, of course, after we enact a public bank, well, then people need to be watchdogging what they're doing. And so we would consider ourselves as being in a watchdog position as that moves forward and as the bank is created. So our objectives are long-term.
That's David Delk of the Portland Public Bank Alliance. In Santa Fe, New Mexico, where one of the most successful citizen efforts appears about ready to complete the long process of development, research, public education, and legislative maneuvering, the City Council in Santa Fe appears to be about ready to take the plunge. Nicole Lykin is one of the first in the country to help organize the effort, which started with a citizens group called We Are People Here.
In the month after our symposium, we had a resolution to create a feasibility study. It was issued in March of the following year, 2015, and it was released in January 2016 and found that a public bank could do really a whole lot for the city of Santa Fe that was not being done.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, a group that I'm part of did our own feasibility study because we wanted something that was a little easier for everyday people to understand. And so we completed a short, simpler version of how a public bank could be set up and be successful within the first year.
Here we are 2.5 years later, and you've gotten to a point where the City Council is ready to take a vote on moving forward with it. But before we talk about that, can you give us a quick glimpse of what kind of impact the public bank was projected to make on a relatively small city like Santa Fe, a small capitalization? What are some of the numbers that would illustrate what a public bank would do, even in a small city like Santa Fe?
Well, the official study showed that a public bank could save the city $24 million in the first 3 years. And our study showed that it could save the city a similar percentage of numbers and generate a profit of over $10 million that could, you know, a percentage of which could be returned to the city for public projects. So it's pretty clear, you know, that if we pay ourselves instead of paying someone else, that our community can really benefit. So after that, there were many questions that weren't answered really in the feasibility study, the official one. And we knew that it would be great to involve the public in it. So our brass tacks team wrote a task force resolution to form a task force of experts from the community and around the country to finish the work that the feasibility study did not address. And so that is what is coming before the City Council, we hope, the end of this month or early next month. And then at that point, a task force, once it's approved, and we anticipate that it will be approved, we think we've got the council votes, then we can move ahead with appointing a task force. And then they've got 6 months to complete the findings and all the work that they need to do, which in government time will probably be about 11 months. But we will have what we need in order to apply for a bank charter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the purpose of the task force is to gather that all that information, the legal questions, answer the legal questions, answer the model for the bank, develop a good 5-year business plan, do the governance, how will transparency and public accountability happen. And so it's a sizable amount of work, but we do have many people that are interested in being involved on the task force. So we're very hopeful. And, you know, the brass tacks team, our public banking nerds team here in Santa Fe, is looking at well, you really need nerds if you're going to do this technical stuff.
You need nerds, you say.
You need nerds, up with nerds. And so we have actually been working right along because we want to have as much available for the task force when they start working as possible, so that they're not having to do all the work that they've got a place to start with. So we're looking at legal issues and the financial issues. We're looking at the laws and the regulations and seeing how they can be amended to enable a public bank. Rather than just writing legislation, looking at the banking laws to allow for a public bank, looking at the regulations and laws governing where public monies can be deposited and how they can be deposited, how we can amend those so that it's consistent with a public bank, because one thing we realized is that all the laws that have been written for banks and for depositing public funds in banks have been written for putting public funds into private banks, and a public bank is quite a different animal.
That's Nicole Lichen, now working with Santa Fe's brass tax team and the former head of the group Banking on New Mexico. Nicole is our secretary of the board of directors at the Public Banking Institute. So now we've had some visits with your neighbors who are taking matters into their own hands and taking definitive steps toward creating a new American institution of banking in the public interest. The road forward is winding and long, but the destination is an objective each of these people thinks is well worth the price. We invite you to join the pilgrimage. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.